no controversy.
That's the problem.
I'm not going to cooperate.
Right. So then the question is, how do we educate the public on the challenges of recycling?
Nobody even knows how recycling gets picked up. She ended up calling me back.
Correct. And that's, you've got to somehow tie all three of these back together. So I think
which tells me she wanted 20 minutes to question the question. I'm no idiot.
I know, that's smart.
I'm not the smartest one.
How are you doing? Good? Good. So I'm the chair of continuum of care. The mayor's office kind of wrote me up.
You know that stuff right about the body, so she didn't get any of the future meetings.
Let me know if I can answer questions about this sector.
I'm the overall vice chair.
I'm impressed.
So I'm trying to and just trying to help out where I can.
And here's my guy to do this all.
Many strong feelings about what could be done. So it's just a matter of resources, right? And that's part of the community. What's your goal? What should you be? Right? There's a cost involved to reach that goal all the way.
He'll be joining my team. But he's up in D.C.
It's too broad.
All right. Well, hey, we might as well call to order the second working group meeting of the homelessness subcommittee of the City Council Special Committee on Critical Quality of Life Issues. I'm Nick Howland, the co-chair of the working group on homelessness, and we have with us my fellow co-chair, Ms. Dawn Gilman. I want to point out a couple of folks in the room. First of all, we have to my left the chair of the City Council Special Committee on Critical Quality of Life Issues. And far to my right over there, we have the vice president of the City Council, Mr. Ron Salem. I will defer to Mr. Boylan and then over there to Mr. Salem if they have comments before we get into the meeting.
I'll keep it very brief. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. This is going to be a marathon. We're going to keep, but a sprint at the same time. So having one in the room and being part of this conversation, contributing to the conversation, I hope. These three meetings today are really more continuing the fact-finding. Evidence-based is what we're focused on here, and I appreciate results, evidence-based results, and I'm looking forward to your continued participation. I thank you, Ms. Gilman and Mr. Councilmember Holland, for your leadership.
Thank you, Chair Boylan. Now over to Vice President Salem.
Thank you, Councilmember Holland. I'm strictly here to assist you and your co-chair and Councilmember Boylan any way that I can, and as well as to learn. That's another reason I'm here. I'm very eager to learn more about this issue and how we can impact it locally.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. So this is two of five of the working groups. This was supposed to be held last week, delayed because of Hurricane Ian. Thank you all for adjusting your schedules. In our last meeting, our charter was to define the scope of the homelessness issue across the city of Jacksonville. We did so, led by Ms. Gilman, and we also played, for context, a game that was developed by the National Alliance to End Homelessness. That was pretty fascinating. Understand kind of at a high level the process that folks go from being unsheltered through homelessness, through emergency shelter, through affordable housing, and so on. That was a fascinating game. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Of the five meetings, the way Chair Boylan had them out is the first one was to understand the scope, all three working groups. First meeting, understand the scope of the issue. Second is understanding what we do now across the city. Third is best practices, so what happens across the nation. And then four and five, find solutions and come up with a recommendation as part of the critical quality of life issue special committee. So what we're doing today is what we do now. And we're very fortunate to have two speakers. One is Dr. Charles Moreland, who is the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for the city, who will go through a presentation. Dr. Moreland, thank you for being here with us today. And then also we have Mr. Joe Savage, who will be joining us by Zoom a little later, who's a Senior Regional Advisor for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, a federal department, and he can talk about what will be going on in about 104 other cities across the nation. So with that, I would like to actually, let's do intros, starting left to right on the table, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Gilman.
Matamron Bacon, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Noel Cobo, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Amber Lehman, ECA for Councilman Hallen.
Michael Boylan, District 6.
Don Gilman, Changing Homelessness CEO.
Charles Moreland, Mayor's Office.
Ron Salem, Group 2 at Large.
Terrific. Thank you. And then I do know that I have a list here of the Homelessness Committee and members, so I will go down the list. If you're here, just raise your hand. First is Angela McKee. All right. Thank you, Angela. Nancy Garcia. Anne-Marie Knight. Ms. Cindy Funkhauser.
She's here.
All right. Ms. Dawn Lockhart. I see her. Allison Martin. Angela Strain. Ashley Pratt. Karina Saladino. Shannon Nasworth. Oh, hey, Kathy. Maceo George, if I pronounce that right. All right. Deirdre Connor.
She's here.
Sarah Schmidt. Tamika Gaines-Holly.
I'm here in her
place. All right, thank you. Laureen Husband. Beth Mixon. Paul Stassi. All right, thank you, sir. Marcus Haight. Monica Solomon. Chiquita Moore. Dr. Charles Moreland's over there. Lauren Steiff, Diana Donovan, Jeff Winkler, and Dwayne Alexander. Well, for those who are here and those who aren't here, thank you very much for volunteering your time and expertise on our working group to help solve the homelessness issue. With that, I'm not the expert on this issue, but the real expert is right next to me, Ms. Dawn Gilman.
All right. Thank you all for coming again, especially with the reschedule due to Hurricane Ian. Just going to go real briefly over what we talked about and did last meeting and what I hope you got from it. From my overview of the system of care, I hope the most important thing is, A, there is a system of care out there. We do have emergency shelter. We have transitional housing, rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing. What I hope you also realized is we have a very large unmet need, meaning what our system is currently, it does not have the capacity for everybody who finds themselves in a housing crisis. With the homeless system simulation, what I hope you saw as you went through the process is permanent supportive housing is really one of our best choices for people who are unsheltered and have high acuity on the streets. That's something that they can get all the supports they need to remain housed. Rapid rehousing is a shorter-term intervention, but it is able to serve a lot more people because there is a turnover of people in and out of those systems. Emergency shelter is critical, yet unless emergency shelter is really housing focused, there is a large turnover back into homelessness. So how do we work to make that better? So That's what the system as it is today. We actually often underestimate how good the system of care is in Jacksonville compared to other large cities. And I think in one way that is completely realistic, right? We walk outside this building and we can see folks who are currently experiencing homelessness. And as a community, we feel everyone should be housed. There should be a place for everyone to go. So with that, I think that gives us the urgency, and why this committee exists is we have what is here right now. How do we make it better? And with that, I'm going to keep it brief and turn it over to Dr. Moreland for his overview.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is definitely an honor to be here with all the community stewards, the folks that are on the ground getting the work done day in and day out. Certainly appreciate the work that you do. And at the end of the day, our goal is to improve processes, to be more efficient in utilization of our resources. So this morning, my goal is to just kind of give you a highlight of the investments that we as a city, and the we being the executive branch of government, along with our legislative branch, our city council, have made over the years, over the past 3 years, FY years, in relationship to these areas that of our concern that this committee and others will be communicating about. There is an importance to look back in order to appreciate where we need to go forward thinking. And so this is not an opportunity for us to spike the ball or do any of that. It's just an opportunity for you to see where those critical investments have been over the last 3 years. Sometimes it's hard to remember what happened yesterday. So we're going to take a little bit of a walk down memory lane just so that we have a perspective, and then we can look at ways in which we can move forward and addressing these critical issues in our community. So snapshot of investments that we'll be talking about, and it's very important for you to know that it's evidence-based data. It's not what I think. It's not what somebody's told me. These are all real numbers, real evidence-based information that we will be sharing, that I will be sharing this morning. And it's important to also remember that, you know, although we're looking at these three different areas, but it's always important to understand that there's a lot of intersections between organizations and programs with other programs. So, you know, there's a correlation intersection that we see. So sometimes the lines of these things can intersect and be a little bit blurred at times. But we're going to walk through it. So the next shows you the priorities of our mayor. We believe that strategic partnerships are the key to success. And we're very proud that this administration under Mayor Curry was the first to create a strategic partnership area within our office, because we recognize the importance of having, you know, that connectivity with our philanthropic population, our nonprofit groups. So we have Don Lockhart and Sarah Smith in our in the mayor's office, providing advising the mayor on critical areas such as the ones in which we're going to talk about today. Also, aligning all of these different things with the community goals framework to create a more common language that is used across all sectors is very important because of these defined investments that we're making within our government. You will see that the dollars that we're investing are significant dollars. So you definitely want to ensure that you have an alignment. So if you look at our investments for our nonprofit organizations, obviously, a total of 336 nonprofits with the investment to 677, which over $390 million worth of investments that you see there. And if you look across the years, you see the 10% to 14% increase associated to all of that. And we'll get into how those dollars are actually, how they play into what we're talking about today and over the next few months. So here's a community goals framework that we, again, want to make sure that we're all aligned and our departments are well aligned, ensuring that dollars and buckets of money that we're putting in different places align with this type of thinking. But our goal is to focus on 3, 8, 9. That's the ones that we'll talk about throughout our day today. 3, vibrant and thriving neighborhoods. 8, health and wellness. And 9, food security and nutrition. Some people may say, well, how did you come up with that framework? Where did that come from? Well, that is based on national and state models. So again, we're looking at evidence-based processes, looking across best practices that are out there, and with national philanthropic organizations and state associations that, you know, really address these types of impacts across all communities. That's where this framework comes from. Here we go. Many of the investments that you see here, that we see showcased here, are strategic partnerships that have been created and invested in to align all of our coordinated services. Urban Rest Stop, the mobile component of it. You see the dollars, I won't read off of the PowerPoints, but you can see the investments that we're making. And it's important for you to know this, that while funding is certainly an important part of the equation, there's no doubt funding is necessary to get to the end means. But without a multi-sector collaboration, I think we all can agree with that, and coordination, funding alone will not create the community impact needed to create system-wide or systemic change. Money alone will not create that. But the chart does show a over $22 million investment impacts in one or more of these critical quality of life areas that we're discussing here. And then over $12 million of coronavirus 19 relief funds were allocated to organizations that focus on one or more of these focused areas. So I just wanted you to get a perspective of that, because again, sometimes things get lost over time as we move forward. This is another. We're excited about the launch of the Community Land Trust. Very, very important to our city. Jacksonville was the first city in the state to have passed this first look ordinance. Our council was involved, obviously, with all of that, which allows Jacksonville Community Land Trust to have the first right of refusal for city-owned property, surplus properties. Very important. Over $12 million investment in the Schoesbacher Enterprise Village. That will create a large supply of affordable housing units to advance our goal of ending homelessness. And then our expedient deployment of $115 million in emergency rental assistance programs directly prevented people and households from eviction and foreclosure. So there's a lot of monies being spent in the areas of affordable and workforce housing. Obviously, there's opportunity for improvement. I said that from the very beginning. But you definitely need to know where we have been over the last 3 years to where we're trying to get now, to make evidence-based decisions on how we move forward. And here it is, some of the activities. We were the first to implement Senate Bill 1339 into local ordinance process, which allows for further development of affordable housing by reducing the zoning and land use burden. But you see where all of these dollars are, being spent. Very important. So when you ask about for workforce senior housing, you see at the bottom of that particular page, at page 7 of my PowerPoint, maybe different on yours, but look at the affordable and senior housing opportunities that we've implemented here in our city. So we're working toward and improving all that, but there's quite a bit of work that has been done in this area, but there's obviously more work to be done. Here's another data point for you. The city has many different types of housing investment. Many of these you may be very well familiar with already. But I just important for you to see that, you know, we're preventing a household from losing their home and becoming homeless by some of these programs that you see here, whether it's new construction or a strategy that serves an important role of ensuring that citizens have places to stay and being able to stay in their homes. These are all the investments that we've made in those areas. And again, this is the executive leadership working with our legislative leadership for these things to take place. And, you know, the job that our city council, our mayor, and our team does, you know, it's not one that is thoughtless. You know, there's a lot of intentional effort that goes into it, but because they see so many bills on a regular basis, week in and week out, sometimes you may forget the investments that they hit the approval button for. These are things that they have done to truly impact our citizens in our community, and we couldn't do it without them. I'm making the talking head this morning, but I couldn't do it without our 19 city council members that are part of that approval process to get things done. Several millions of dollars have been invested in this area. Here we are, affordable housing, workforce, and all. Look at this. This chart showcases approximately $180 million dedicated to affordable and workforce housing. And I won't read the chart for you, but I can talk about $6.5 million from FY19 to 22 and SHIP funding, $4.8 million, and the Down Payment Assistance Program, $450,000 in Community Land Trust, for another $4 million in permanent support housing, acquisition and rehabilitation through the CDBG process. Very significant funding. And then here it is. The community can be very proud of the efforts that we've made in trying to reduce or eliminate homelessness. I know, you know, we all are very much a fan of ensuring that takes place, but there's been a considerable effort and progress made in this area, and it is all because that we've been able to work together. That's the key. It's been a collaborative effort. No one person in this room has all the answers to solve all the problems. It's a collaboration of effort by all stakeholders for us to get to the point where we see this type of tremendous progress in this area. In 2017, the mayor launched a task force on homelessness and realized many successful initiatives associated with that, even during the time we were dealing with COVID-19. Even during that time. So when you look at this, 35% decrease since 2015, 52% decrease over the last 10 years. Those are amazing numbers. But as I said before, no spiking of the ball. Obviously realize that there's more opportunity out there, and we want to work toward that. That's what this group and others are about, trying to work toward all of that. But our success depends upon everybody in the room. But we can certainly say that we've been very successful in our current efforts in reducing homelessness, even during a worldwide pandemic. Those are facts. This is just a sample of many different strategies we have worked on together. Very important that we can pull in all these resources, all these different areas of our community to help in this goal and our efforts. And everybody has been very supportive in it. Won't spend too much time there, but please make sure you go back to these slides, your PowerPoint, later today, over the weeks and all, and ask questions. We definitely have our subject matter experts in the audience, Ms. Lockhart, Ms. Smith, Sarah, Chiquita Moore from Housing Neighborhoods, and Tom Daly. All of them are here to provide you more drill-down understanding of all of these investments that they've been responsible for getting out to the community. Here's another one. The Mayor's Homeless Task Force goal, urban rest stop, very much a big deal. That's a considerable investment. It is a key investment that has led to success. We're also very proud that Jacksonville is only two cities in the nation, and this is interesting, to have been recognized for an effective COVID response to ensure the safety of our most vulnerable citizens. Many of you were a part of that process. When we were dealing with all of that and trying to come up with a strategy to make it work. So we're very proud of that. But these are some of the highlighted investments in those areas. Homelessness, again, here's another example of how much involvement, investments that we've made over the years, over the last 3 years. It is not inclusive to all the investments made by the city, but this is just a point-in-time look. These numbers are changing, probably even as I speak, are changing, okay? But this chart reports investments that support emergency assistance for homelessness totaling well over $14 million. And then there are other pieces to that. Here we are. Our successful navigation through the pandemic was a result of many strategic investments that we made. But over the past 9 years, the city of Jacksonville has invested well over $260 million at UF Health, Jacksonville for Indigent Healthcare Services. Our investment of over $39 million of COVID-19 vaccination and testing ensured that the safety and well-being of our citizens. And then over $95 million capital improvement investment and UF Health will ensure they have the critical infrastructure to continue to deliver critical services in the community. Those are true investments. Some of those investments were just approved by our council members last week at our budget hearing on Tuesday, right before we got involved with Hurricane Ian. Thank you for that, council members. All right, let's get this thing. Go to the next slide. So we talked about here's some of the preventative measures that we've done. A lot of times people forget about all these preventatives that we've done as a community, as a city, and interventions that we've been involved with, different programs that have been very helpful in this area of healthcare that we'll talk about at a later time a little bit more. But here is more access to health care. That's $306 million investment in health care and prevention and intervention. That's what you're looking at right there. So, and I won't add more to that, but just want you to know those are the types of investments that your city has been making over the last 3 years. And here we are. What I want you to take away from this chart is the continued investment in increases in indigent health care in Health Zone 1 and with our community partners. If you notice from 14-15 to 22-23, it's not a proposed now, it's approved. You see one from $26 million to $40 million. That's not including the CIP capital improvement project of $95 million that I just recently talked about. So you can see all of that investment right there for the UF Health. And even our Department of Health, we've certainly invested over $4 million from 18 to 22 to the Duval County Health Department for a variety of programs that they have and running. So here it is. Some of these charts are here. You'll be able to see critical quality of life investments, and this just breaks it out as it relates to health care, combination of those, homelessness, COVID-19 relief, affordable housing, and all of that. So you can see how it breaks it down. But the point here is this. That's over $528 million of investment by the city over the last 3 years. $528 million. So when sometimes people think that the city is not doing anything, the reality is your executive branch of government and your legislative branch of government are doing quite a bit. It may not be as much enough It may be other opportunities that we can look at to strengthen some things, but I want to make sure that everybody comes away with the understanding that, you know, the city government is doing quite a bit in these areas. And we can obviously look toward doing more, but we're doing quite a bit. Here's another chart, a significant showcase of all the funding that we've gotten, that we've done. That $528 million that I just mentioned, this is total of all of that. PSG, CDBG, all of that funding, $528 million of all investments. So this gives you a much more comprehensive view and how you can better understand what policies and additional investments that can create more impact, the most impact, in these critical quality of life investments. All right, and I'll wrap up with this, and I thought this was very important. Each strategy and investment is complex and intersects with multiple organizations and initiatives that they may have. The data is certainly not inclusive of all the investments made by the city, but just to reiterate a little point in time of known funding, but if it's 3 years, it does not include proposed budget. The data will be updated accordingly. We have a team of folks that are keeping this data updated. Our goal is to have this data smartly driven where it's available to the public to see. Sometimes the public doesn't understand the investments that the executive and legislative branch have made in these bucketed areas in our community because we get caught up in the conversation, but we don't always understand the total investments that we've made. So our continuous improvement efforts to become a more data-driven city. We want to make data and smart decisions based upon evidence-based data. What are those steps to ensure that it's citizen-focused data? And so that's why it mentions that our goal is to upload this data on a regular basis so all can view it and know it and see where all of these investments are at. One of the things that I do want to make sure I don't miss is that, you know, when we offer space for programs to operate without a cost associated to it, there may not be a cost to that agency. There is an in-kind cost to the city that we can certainly project out and actually utilize as a number for us in these areas. So again, we're trying to continue to work with our government, our different interdepartmental folks. As I mentioned, we're continuing to advance our interdepartmental grant strategy and develop a matrix banking dashboard that we can demonstrate progress over the years. So whatever this committee and other committees come up with, and whatever there's any dollars associated with that, we'll be able to track all of that. And this last part, I just want to make sure they're very clear on. As government is only one part of the equation, I think we all agree with that. It is a strong recommendation that you also conduct the same landscape analysis of the private and philanthropic investments made in these three areas to ensure you have an accurate picture of where the gaps are at. I just provided you a bunch of information about all of the investments that are happening in our city and in all of these areas. Whether it's affordable housing, workforce housing, health care, or homelessness, you just got that. But we definitely need to make sure that we're doing a true analysis, an evidence-based analysis, to see the accurate picture to ensure that we are addressing the gaps. Because without that information, you won't be able to make an informed slate of recommendations to the committees in which you all are serving. So that's my presentation, Mr. Chair. Just wanted you to be aware of what the council and the mayor have been able to do over these past 3 years. And again, we could not do any of that without the support of our city council members. So thank you for that, and thank you for having me this morning.
Are there any
immediate questions. We can take just a few before we have, yes.
I love that you ended on the gaps, because literally before you said that, I wrote in the notes that there's been so much done, but where are the holes? Why do we still struggle in these areas? But how do we define the holes? So how do we find where those gaps are so that we can work together to close them?
It's a very good point, and that's the reason why I close with that, and thank you for acknowledging that. I think the goal was to just to ensure that we're not starting from functional zero. We're starting from up here, but we just got to figure out those areas in which we can make those considerable leaps and improvements in. And so I wanted to make sure that the committee, the folks in the audience, the folks that are looking at us on television, recognize that we have made considerable investments in all of those areas and that we're continuing to make them. And so, but how can we improve in that area and making evidence-based decisions, not just emotional decisions based on how we feel about something, but evidence-based decisions so that we can move the needle forward.
And if you're looking specifically for information on homeless needs assessments, I will send a link that will go out with the information to the Changing Homelessness website. We have not done a needs assessment since pre-COVID, but there is one up there. There's also one on strategies to reduce unsheltered homelessness, which goes into who is out there and what it would take. Again, this was pre-COVID. We'll do the watch this space. We are doing a new one. We're trying to. There is one that we did with focus strategies on specifically on who was homeless and who was served pre-COVID through the pandemic. So there is information that we're talking about there that will be could be helpful to you with what you're looking for. One more question.
Al Barlow, here for the homeless. And I just want to have two questions. Number one, is it accurate to say that, and first of all, thank you for the excellent presentation.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you and the mayor and the city council for all that you are doing. I really appreciate it. We all know that, as you acknowledged, that a lot more can be done. Mm-hmm. Two questions. Number one, is it safe to say that those figures that you gave can be pretty much divided by three? Is this based on three fiscal years?
So there's a connectivity to all 3 years from 19 to 22. That's correct.
Okay.
But it's a total investment of the $528 million that we just spoke about.
Okay. And I'm looking at that pie right there, and I was like an eagle waiting on the figure that represented that small piece for homelessness. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, I'm glad that y'all separated homelessness from affordable housing. But here's my second question. I want to make sure I have this right, because I looked at $14,185,907.07 for homelessness spent from 19, 20, 21, and 22, those three fiscal years. When I divided that by three, I came up with $4,728,635.59 per year. Is that accurate?
So, go ahead, Don. Don will help you with that.
Okay.
The reason that we made sure to present all the data for all three areas is because, as Dr. Moreland has said, they're all completely intersected. And so, and two examples I can give you is, for example, the funding that goes to Sulzbacher for the Bradley Qualified Healthcare Center is not in the space of homelessness on that chart, because they serve low and moderate income individuals in addition to individuals who are experiencing homelessness. So those dollars are in healthcare. The funding that's going, that was invested to support Sulzbacher developing a new enterprise village of $12 million is not in homelessness, because that is in affordable housing. So you have to go deeper into the data to understand the intersections between them, and we'll be able to provide more of that information to you. So it's not, I appreciate what you're trying to get at, but it is not as definitive as what you're trying to get to.
I'm just asking whether it's accurate to divide that figure 14 million by 3 years and come up with whatever the figure is. I'm just asking, is
that? You have to understand also that there are additional dollars that came in during COVID, et cetera. So we'll be happy to give you the specifics on that at a later date.
What I want to know is that figure.
Okay. What is, okay, you just told us, you did a good job of telling us what's not in there. Tell us what is in that red figure right there. What goes in there?
We wanted to also highlight the fact that there's a fourth category, which is combination. There are many investments that the city of Jacksonville makes that are more than one. And so we had to create a fourth one, especially because homelessness really does intersect with housing as well as healthcare. There is housing is healthcare concept, food is medicine. There is just so much intersection between the three that there were those, especially within the homelessness category, that we couldn't just place there because it was intersection with housing or with healthcare. So that's why that fourth category is there. Also, our COVID-19 relief grants, many of those organizations, they serve the people that are experiencing homelessness. So there really is just... You know, this is an idea of those that fit distinctly in one of those three, but even so, there is just so much overlap.
I got it. I'm just trying to find out what's in that figure. I mean, what's in the red? What programs, what you told us what's not in there. I get that. What is in there? I was just trying to find out. Where is that $14 million going for those 3 years?
So we'll bring that data back to this committee and dissect it in much more detail. So
can I get access to it?
Certainly.
Can I?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. This information is public.
Okay, and I think Dr. Moreland has a quick comment.
Yeah, so there could very well be some questions from you and others in relationship to the data. Feel free to connect with our team. If we don't have the answer for you today as it relates to drilling down, we will get that answer for you and provide it to the committee and go from there. But I just wanted to kind of give you a high-level overview of it all. But to their points, information does the different programs do intersect with other programs. There's a lot of overlap there that may not have been, drilled down into specifically in the presentation, but we can definitely do that for you. And I made that commitment to you that we'll make sure that happens.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, sir.
And do you mind if I borrow that real quick? Mine doesn't seem to be working.
Okay,
now it works. All right, I'll give it right back to you. I just wanted to maybe put a hold on any questions until a little bit later because we have Mr. Joe Savage who has joined us by Zoom, and he's getting ready to do a presentation on Built for Zero. I think Dr. Moreland's going to step out, but we still do have staff here, including Ms. Lockhart, who could answer any further questions during the member discussion and public comment period of the agenda. And in the meantime, before we turn it over to Mr. Savage, I just want to say we have been joined by our fearless leader on City Council President Terrence Freeman over there. Thank you, sir, for joining us today. And back over to Ms. Gilman.
So it is my pleasure to introduce Joe Savage, who works for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, USICH. This is the federal agency that is tasked with coordinating all of the federal dollars that are focused on ending homelessness. I have worked with Joe for a number of years as they are the agency that puts out a framework on what does it actually mean to make progress towards ending homelessness, and what does it mean to reach what is known as functional zero? And with that, Joe, I see your presentation is up, and are you there? All right, we're gonna work on the mic. Okay.
If he goes to mute and clicks it
now. Yay!
All right, great, wonderful. Good morning, everyone. It's certainly a pleasure to be here with you all. Dong, thank you for the invitation. And I certainly thank you all in the city of Jacksonville for the work that you have been doing. As Dawn mentioned, I've been working with her for a number of years, and she keeps me abreast of the work that's going on in Jacksonville. And she's always bringing those issues up to us at the federal level in terms of the challenges that you all experience. So what I'm going to do this morning, I'm not speaking specifically about Built for Zero because I'm from USICH, But I do want to talk about a concept that's related to the work that is done within Built for Zero in terms of targeted solutions when it comes to ending homelessness. Communities have gotten a vast amount of dollars due to the COVID-19 pandemic, whether it's COVID relief dollars or American Rescue Plan ARP dollars. And one of our key priorities at the federal level is to ensure that communities are being strategic and intentional about where they focus those dollars so that communities can make the largest impact in the quickest amount of time. And the reason why we say that is because this type of money most likely is not going to come around again. So we really want to make sure that communities are being strategic in the use of these dollars, and they are targeting them very specifically and intentionally. So here's my information. As introduced, I'm Dr. Joe Savage. I'm a senior regional advisor with United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. My region covers the Mid-Atlantic and Southeastern states, which includes Florida. So certainly take down my contact information, especially my email. I really serve as your link to the federal government. If you have any questions about federal policy, programs, funding, need to reach out to a federal agency, I can certainly serve as that link. And as I mentioned, email is the easiest way to get in touch with me. So Dawn briefly touched on our role at USICH. We are the federal government's entity that's responsible for coordinating federal policy around the issue of homelessness. And we essentially do that by convening 19 federal agencies around a common vision and a common plan for what it means to prevent and end homelessness. So when we talk about that common vision, that common goal, it's really about reducing silos and each individual agency operating in its own silo when it comes down to addressing homelessness and making it easier for you all, the communities, rather than the VA having their priorities, HUD having a different set of priorities, and Health and Human Services having their own sets of priorities, and communities are trying to go after the funding but have to meet 14 different priorities for 14 different agencies. We ensure that the agencies are coordinated around a common vision, a common set of priorities, and a common goal as it relates to preventing and ending homelessness. And we do that through our council. And the council consists of 19 federal agencies, and typically the representative for each agency is that agency's secretary. So right now, our council chair is VA Secretary McDonough, and our council vice chair is HHS Secretary Becerra. And so as far as our current priorities at the federal level, the Biden-Harris administration has made housing first and housing as a right a key priority. Housing isn't something that someone should have to deserve or something that they should have to earn, but it's something that is a right. And also a focus on racial equity, which I'm sure you all have probably been hearing a lot about. We know that persons of color are disproportionately impacted by the issue of homelessness, as well as those issues that lead and cause homelessness. So we want communities to really focus on racial equity and really looking at the racial dynamics within their homelessness crisis response system, as well as economic mobility in terms of giving people the tools and the keys necessary to move and graduate out of homelessness and be able to live independently. And then finally, climate change. And this is something, you know, I'm glad that you all are safe in light of Hurricane Ian and climate change as it relates to homelessness, because people get displaced as a result of natural disasters. So these are the priorities in terms of homelessness that the Biden-Harris administration has set forth. And those priorities are going to be reflected in the upcoming federal strategic plan. Some of you may be familiar with the original strategic plan released in 2010, Opening Doors. Then we released another federal strategic plan, Home Together. And under the current administration, we went through another set of revision, getting community feedback, getting input from stakeholders, persons with lived experience, and probably within the next 3 weeks or so, we should be releasing this new federal strategic plan that's really going to be based on the administration's priorities as well as evidence-based practices, and it's going to be rooted in housing first principles. So look out for that. If you haven't already, I suggest going to our website, www.usich.gov, and signing up for a newsletter. That way, when anything new comes out and new policy priorities, you all will be made abreast of that. So what are some of our results? Since the release of Opening Doors, that first federal strategic plan, these are numbers based on the point in time count, and these are national numbers. The point in time count from 2010 to 2020, with overall homelessness being down by 9%, we've seen an uptick in chronic homelessness, and that's primarily due to a lot of coastal cities, particularly out on the West Coast, where housing costs are skyrocketing, and they're really experiencing a crisis as it relates to chronic homelessness. Family homelessness down by 29%. Veterans homelessness is down by 50% nationwide, and within veterans homelessness, unsheltered veterans homelessness is down by 56%. And I want you to keep that number, that 50% reduction, in mind as I lead more into the targeting as it relates to targeted solutions. And then youth homelessness down by 11%. So this is the progress that we've made nationally from 2010 to 2020 based on the annual point in time count numbers. So at the federal level, and I believe you all may have gotten some education around the federal criteria and benchmarks and the definition as far as what it means to end homelessness at the federal level. So in developing that common vision, those common goals for what it means to end homelessness in the United States, we have developed a definition for what it means to bring an end to homelessness. And at the federal level, we use the term effectively ending homelessness. And essentially, when we talk about ending homelessness at the federal level, it's not about a number. It's not about getting down to zero. Of course, that is a great goal, and we would want communities to get down to zero. But as long as there are other social inequities and issues within other social systems, we're always going to have people falling into homelessness. And so when we talk about effectively ending homelessness at the federal level and what we have operationalized as that definition, we're looking at a community system. We're looking at your homelessness response system and how it's designed. And we want your system to be designed in such a way that homelessness is rare, it's brief, and it's one time, meaning people rarely fall into homelessness. So that speaks to the prevention end of your system. And then for those who do end up falling into homelessness, that it's brief. They're not homeless for an extended period of time. And then once they exit homelessness, they're given the necessary services and supports so that they don't return to homelessness. So when we talk about what it means to end homelessness at the federal level, we're looking at a community's system and how that system is designed and how it functions so that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time. So if we have that definition that we've operationalized, how do we know that communities have developed that system so that it's rare, brief, and one time? Well, we've developed criteria and benchmarks. And those criteria and benchmarks look at a community system, and the criteria define what that system should look like. And then the benchmarks are the data points so that if a community says, okay, we do have these elements in place within our system so that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time, then it'll play out in the data. And the data is typically generated by the community's by name list, which is one of the elements of the system, where they have an active, ongoing, live list of all persons in the community that are experiencing homelessness, and using that data to calculate the benchmarks. So the criteria look at the system in terms of the elements of its design that should be in place. And then the benchmarks are the data points that will prove whether or not those specific elements are in place within that system. And so as we start moving into targeting, as you'll see on this slide, we have criteria and benchmarks for each specific subpopulation. So within the criteria and benchmarks, and within our definition for effectively ending homelessness, We have targeted those criteria and benchmarks for each subpopulation. So we have the criteria and benchmarks for veterans, families, youth, and chronically homeless individuals. And each subpopulation has a unique set of criteria and benchmarks that are targeted, that are specific for that subpopulation. And so when we look at how we design the criteria and benchmarks, as you can see, we're already moving into targeting towards specific subpopulations. And the reason being is that those subpopulations have different needs. There are different funding sources that can go towards those subpopulations. And so we really want communities to be able to take the criteria and benchmarks and really begin to target and to drill down within those subpopulations. And so when we look at our progress to date, so we're looking at the criteria and benchmarks that have been broken out by subpopulation. We have 83 communities plus three states that have effectively ended veterans homelessness. And so essentially a community can get confirmation from us at the federal level that they have effectively ended homelessness for a particular subpopulation. So we have those 83 communities plus three states that have gotten a confirmation for effectively ending veterans homelessness. One community, and that's actually Orlando, Florida, who has received confirmation for effectively ending chronic homelessness amongst veterans. And then we have three communities that have effectively ended chronic homelessness. So what these communities are showing is that you can get to a point where your system is designed so that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time for a particular subpopulation. And they were able to get there by targeting their resources towards that specific subpopulation. And remember on that previous slide, I showed you the progress that we've made nationally amongst veterans with that reduction by 56%. That is a key example of what happens when you have targeted resources towards a particular population and the progress that you can make. And so we were able to make that progress because the Veterans Administration, as well as the Department of Health and Human Services, and basically behind all of that is Congress. Congress put up the money to specifically target resources for veterans. And because they put up the money to target specifically towards veterans, we were really able to make significant progress with that subpopulation. And so our argument back to Congress is, look at the progress that we can make when you have those enough resources that are specifically targeted for that subpopulation, and we can really move the needle. And so what I want to do now is I want to look at a couple of communities, and I want to show you what happens when the community takes their dollars, their funding, and they target not just a specific subpopulation, let's say chronically homeless individuals, but even when they drill down further, a particular subpopulation within the chronically homeless individual population, when they really target and they really get strategic with their funding, they can really move the needle and really drive down those numbers, which is different from spreading the dollars evenly across all populations. But when you really target and you're really intentional and you really drill down those dollars towards a specific subpopulation, you can really make significant progress. So the city of Philadelphia, that's actually where I live. I'm Philly born and raised. And so I always love to use Philly as an example because they're doing great work. They have an initiative called Philly Cares. And basically Philly Cares is an initiative that came out of the mayor's office that is supported by the downtown business district in the hospitality and tourism industry. They actually lead this initiative in conjunction with the COC. And it's really about sharing spaces, sharing public spaces. How can we design the downtown district so that no one is excluded from sharing public space, but it's an inclusive sharing of public spaces? So this particular initiative targets unsheltered persons who are experiencing homelessness that are located in the downtown and central business districts. And that next bullet point, those are the entities that put up the dollars, put up the funding to support this initiative. And as you can see, it came from the business community, and it is this community that actually leads this initiative. So essentially, this is an initiative that targets the dollars towards a specific subpopulation. They were very strategic. The unsheltered homeless population in the downtown central business district. And as a result of targeting those resources, panhandling is down by 39%, daytime homelessness down by 34.5% from 2019. And then overnight homelessness in that district is down by 60%. And that's the overall trend over the past 3 years. So this is an example of what happens when you are intentional with resources and you're targeting those resources towards a specific population, you can really make significant progress. And then Orlando, Florida, they had an initiative called Housing the First 100. And basically this initiative took resources and the key driver was, it was back then the Seventh-day Adventist Health System is now Advent Health. They put it in $14 million towards this initiative. And essentially the resources from this initiative were targeted towards what they call the top 100 frequent flyers. And when they talk about the frequent flyers, what they did was they took hospital data, law enforcement data, and some other data points, and they basically did an analysis to determine who are the top 100 chronically homeless individuals who are using these systems. Because as you know, there is a great cost to the healthcare system as well as the justice system when people are frequent users or frequent flyers of those systems, particularly amongst those who are experiencing homelessness. So they targeted these resources specifically towards the top 100 frequent flyers. And in terms of the outcomes that they've seen, they've housed 250 individuals with a 98% retention rate. And so they actually started out with a goal of just the 100, and they exceeded that goal and reached 250, and they have that very high housing retention rate. So again, this is an example of the impact that can be made when you take dollars and resources and you're really strategic and you really target them towards a specific population. And then with the next two examples, and I'll conclude with these two, I want to use these examples again, showing you what happens when you target specific resources, but not just the housing impact, but the impact that it has on other systems within your community. So this is Moore Place in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was an 85-unit permanent supportive housing project. They targeted chronically homeless individuals with mental illness and or substance use disorders. And they actually expanded this project. I believe it's up to 250 units now. And it was operated by a local nonprofit, and it was based in and rooted in Housing First. And in terms of the outcomes that they saw over the two-year period, 2013 to 2015, they had an 81% housing retention rate. They had an 81% reduction in ER visits, a 62% reduction in the number of days of hospital admission. And when they calculated that cost, it came out to be a $2.4 million reduction in hospital costs. They had an 82% reduction in arrests, an 89% reduction in the number of days spent in jail, and an average income increase of 76%. So I wanted to put this program in here, and I'm actually in the process of getting current data on their outcomes from this community to show you, again, when you target resources towards a specific population and you're intentional and strategic about it, these are the impacts that can have on the entire community and other systems, and an example of the cost savings that can occur as a result of that. And then finally, the Indiana Permanent Supportive Housing Initiative. This was 140 units of permanent supportive housing targeted for chronically homeless individuals. And again, it was operated under a Housing First approach. And they actually used this program as a pilot, as a research pilot. And that's the research question that they were answering. And it was really a research study that was done to question the effectiveness of a Housing First approach. And so here were the outcomes from this particular project. And again, I'm showing the outcomes on other systems and the cost savings. So an average of $1,149 in cost savings per person compared to the traditional means of addressing homelessness. So essentially, Housing First means taking someone from homelessness and putting them directly into housing, plus giving them the necessary services. And it's always important to understand that Housing First just isn't about taking someone and putting them directly into housing, but it's the housing plus the services. So when you compare a Housing First approach to the traditional approach where everyone goes into emergency shelter, then everyone goes into transitional housing, and then once they're quote-unquote ready, they then graduate into permanent housing. So when they compare the Housing First approach to the traditional approach, they had an approximate savings of $1,150 per person. And then and other outcomes for this project, they had a 100% reduction in the use of emergency shelters, 83% savings associated with incarceration, a 78% savings for medical hospitalizations, a 66% savings for emergency room services, and 62% savings for mental health hospitalizations. So between Philadelphia, Orlando, Charlotte, North Carolina, and this example here in Evansville, Indiana, what you can really see are the results, both economically as well as socially, that can be achieved, as well as the reductions in the numbers of persons who are homelessness, as well as the savings from the impact on other systems. What can be done when you take resources and you're strategic about the use of those resources and you target those resources towards a specific population versus spreading those resources broadly across all populations. So these were just communities that were examples of that specific targeting. And again, when we talk about the recent COVID-19 relief dollars as well as ARP dollars, what our biggest priority at the federal level is that communities are strategic about the use of those dollars, they're intentional in terms of where they target those dollars, and try to make the most impact, the deepest impact with these dollars, because again, these dollars communities most likely will not see it again. And so again, this is our website, www.usich.gov. Please go there, make sure you sign up for our newsletter so that you can get our latest information, particularly when the federal strategic plan gets released. And again, here is my contact information, and I am here for you. Just reach out to me via email if you have any questions or any concerns about policy and programs at the federal level as they relate to homelessness. And so that's it for me. Thank you.
Joe, thank you so much. And I believe you still have a few minutes if there's any questions from the audience. Is that correct?
Yep.
All right. Yes, absolutely. And this is Ron Salem, who is with our city council.
I just wanted to comment, we are doing this. Our mental health offender program, and Cindy's back here, we did exactly what this gentleman is talking about. We reviewed records to determine who were the frequent, and we called them frequent flyers. One gentleman with a mental health problem been arrested 97 times in 3 years. We identified that population when they were rearrested. We approached them, do you want to stay in jail, or do you want to get treatment, wraparound services? And we are providing those services. And this was a pilot project that is being interestingly honored tonight of all nights through the transformation program that that the Soulspacker does. And we have been very successful, and we have tracked the cost savings of arrests and them staying in jail and all those. All the things he mentioned, we are doing this. Now, it is a very small population right now, but it just shows if you focus those dollars on something very narrow, what you can do. And that program is going to get expanded. And I'm hopeful as we look at a new jail down the road and those types of things, that this program will be one that we'll look at and say, we can reduce the size of the jail. We don't need all those, and we can divert and treat these people more humanely through this a program such as that. So I just wanted to make that comment as if we're doing this.
So I would also like to acknowledge the other nonprofits in the room that are doing these other pieces. There is nothing that Joe talked about that has not been piloted here locally. I'm looking at Paul Stassi, who during the COVID did a low-barrier shelter for us, and that demonstrated how we could get people off the streets that had never come off. If you want to see other cost savings, Ability Housing did a pilot with the state with Medicare dollars on clearly proving that housing is healthcare. So when we, and as you ask Joe these questions, I'm just going to set it up slightly. So what I was going to tee up afterwards is as a group, we need to decide what is our goal, right? Like, what is the goal that we want to achieve? The next question is, what is the cost to achieve that goal? While it can seem overwhelming, it is pretty basic math. We are running different programs throughout our continuum of care locally that have real dollars and real data for that. And then the third question, this is the one I added in after COVID-19, is who does the work? Right now, we have, as a system, have been asked to do a lot in the last 2 years. And it's finding those agencies that still have the capacity to be able to expand when they are given that opportunity. So I love the examples that Joe did. They're some of the best across the country. And I will tee up to get you back for our fourth meeting. We are going to have a panel with Minneapolis, Miami, and Atlanta, who have done some different things also related to how do you work together with a city or county, nonprofits, and other other philanthropy to make large system changes. So with that, I'm going to stop talking and see who might have a question.
Got Cindy in the back.
Okay, well, Cindy in the back. Are you going
to? Cindy had a question before that one. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. And we are asking questions to please come to the podium.
And Cindy had one before I cut everyone off.
Oh, okay.
So she might want to start before we go to Reverend Barlow. Cindy, I didn't see you waving your hand back there before we got up.
This way Joe can also see you.
That's right.
First of all, I just want to say, yes, we are doing a lot of these programs, the MHOP program, the CHOP program, very similar to what Ability Housing has been doing. Those are targeted programs. But the one thing I don't hear us talking about, Joe, are you still on there? You talked about economic mobility. And we're talking a lot about housing. We have a whole separate task force that's talking about building housing. So it's housing first, but not housing only. Cannot be housing only. And what we're not talking about at all, and I'm sure these folks are going to agree, even if you give someone housing, they need income. And with the MHOP and the CHOP program, we make sure that if a person qualifies for benefits, they're going to get that income through a SOAR processor. We need to talk about those kind of services as well to make sure that we have people connecting people to the benefits that they might need, the income, but also to jobs. And I know Paul Stassi is big on this. The Enterprise Village, enterprise means jobs. That's what that village is based on. It's based on trying to make sure people have the tools that they need. Yes, we'll put them in housing first. But they're going to need the tools to maintain that housing, to have the income that they need to permanently leave poverty and leave homelessness. So I hope we're going to talk more in this group because we have the housing group, and that's the most important thing. No ifs, ands, or buts about that. But Joe, economic mobility, you mentioned that as one of the administration's priorities. Can you give us any examples of how people in other cities are able to establish economic opportunity and mobility programs?
Sure. In other communities, when we talk about particularly, as you mentioned, housing first, and again, emphasizing housing first is the housing and the services. It's not just the housing first. It's the housing and the services. And within that services component is where you see the economic mobility in terms of connections to workforce development. So what we see in other communities are developing real strong relationships with their local workforce development as well as their community colleges and really creating pipelines for homeless people experiencing homelessness to have access to education resources as well as workforce training. And something that was unique that was done in Philadelphia with Wells Fargo Bank, they actually developed a specific pipeline to employment for persons experiencing homelessness, where it was a specific training program where they just didn't train them for jobs that they could get at Wells Fargo, but Wells Fargo had actual positions that these people were being trained to move into. So a lot of communities are working with local businesses, they're working with their local community college to really develop these pipelines to job training, to employment, as well as to education, so that people's wages and incomes can increase and they can have that economic mobility.
Thank you. And I think who has, okay.
Mr. Conyers.
Conyers, Mr. Barlow.
Good morning, Harrison Conyers with City of Jackson Military Affairs and Veterans Department. I wanted to advise to support what Cindy had just said. We have a program here in City Hall, the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, that connects veterans not only to the housing, but to the support services, to the training that's needed, and to the employment. And we also work with the employers. So we've got an 84% success rate of the veterans that we bring in off the street, that we connect with the housing providers, and we connect with the employers of non-recidivism and back into the system. So we're getting them in jobs, and they are becoming self-sufficient. So we are ending their homelessness. So that is a very crucial part of the solution for those that are able to work, and that we can provide the wraparound services to help them work and truly get off the street.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Savage. My name is Alvin Wellington Barlow. I'm a pastor, and I help homeless people. So I'm a person that's on the ground as opposed to a person that's pushing paper and pencils in the office. Not no offense to anybody who does that. But here's my question for you. One of the phrases that, and I thank you for your excellent presentation, one of the phrases that you continue to articulate to us this morning is strategic targeting of funding. And so my question centers around that. I'm looking at, you probably can't see this, but I'm looking at a pie-shaped exhibit here with homelessness. This has COVID relief funds, access to health care, affordable housing, and homelessness. And homelessness, and there's also one for combination, but homelessness is about 10% of that pie. So my question to you is, can a city have the kind of successes that you so well articulated this morning if we're only putting about 10% of those kind of resources to target homelessness exclusively? Can you get those kind of results that you articulated so well this morning?
Sorry, I was on mute. It really depends on the city. So when we talk about being intentional and targeting those dollars and being strategic, the city has to do an analysis of their data to determine what the needs are, and then based on that analysis, determine how to target and be strategic with those funding resources. So $10 million could be sufficient for City A to be strategic with those resources, to, let's say, make an impact with chronically homeless individuals. But with City B, $10 million may not be enough, because based on their needs assessment, that's just not going to get them anywhere. So it could be, but it would depend on your local data and you all's local needs assessment, if that is sufficient.
Thank you. I just want to clarify and ask a follow-up question. We're talking about a city of over a million people.
See, I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't have to know Jacksonville's. I wouldn't have to know your needs assessment, basically, to be able to determine that. But maybe someone in that room can speak to whether or not $10 million is sufficient for Jacksonville.
And how appropriate, because we have City of Jacksonville. Sarah?
Yes.
Thank you.
Hi, Sarah Schmidt, Mayor's Office. And so I wanted to provide some examples, what is included in that $10 million, as well as what those overlap and combination dollars that we talked about. So for Changing Homelessness, they received COVID-19 CBG CFE funding for non-congregate shelter space. That was $2.3 million. You had HOPWA funding to Catholic Charities for short-term rent, mortgage, utility assistance. You have PSG funding to Hubbard House for their emergency shelter program. Those are just some specific examples. The MHOP program that we were talking about, that's an overlap between affordable health care as well as homelessness, so that's an example of a combination. We also had homelessness COVID-19 testing that went to changing homelessness that was dispersed. We had a lot of housing dollars is in our workforce housing and affordable housing homelessness overlap. We have HMIS funding that we provide every year. We have the Downtown Ambassadors Life Builders Program, which is a partnership between CRM and Downtown Vision. We have the HVRP program that Harrison was talking about. Those are just some of the examples of the funding that we include in that $10 million, but a lot of the funding is an overlap, because in homelessness, there is so much overlap between housing. Housing first, obviously, that model, so there's a ton of investment that's in the combination area. If you look at the slides that we provide, there are some examples of PSG and ESG funding on slide 12. There's some specific investments that we highlighted, especially with supportive housing, rapid rehousing, transitional housing. And then on page 11, there's also just some of those strategies that we're also investing in. We're assisting with that coordination, which I think is so important. But also we're funding those strategies that we're a part of as the city. Whether that's the co-responder team, you have Homeward Bound program, you have MHOP and CHOP, you have HVRP. We're involved in Built for Zero. Those are things that I think as a city, we're looking at the funding, but also the strategy is so important. The Mayor's Downtown Homeless Task Force, the Urban Rest Stop was born out of that task force, and we have consistently funded that. Plus did parking lot upgrades to support the Urban Rest Stop for over $1 million. So those are just some examples of the investments, but I think a key part of that is also the strategy. The work that our departments are doing, the neighborhoods department, housing, they're doing such an important part of that, but a lot of our departments touch so many of these different organizations and programs. And so I think the investment is important, but also knowing that within homelessness, this is the category that overlaps the most. And so that's why you see a smaller number. I don't think that that is representative of the investment, both in kind. We also provide in-kind donation of land for housing. So those are just some important things to keep in mind when we're looking at these numbers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you go after Mr. Stassi?
You're next, sir, after Mr. Stassi.
All right, Paul Stassi, CEO of City Rescue Mission. And first, I'd like to acknowledge Donna and thank you for what you said about how we all, as service providers, work together. I've been in this field for 21 years as a service provider, and I'm part of a national association of rescue missions called CityGate. So I know what's happening in a lot of cities around the country. And I know firsthand that we work really well together here at Jackson, all of the service providers, and I'm really thankful for that. Also, what Cindy said about, and actually Harrison too, about jobs, it's key, because someone can go into a house, but what about sustainability? And jobs or some other form of income is a big component of that. Jobs give dignity. So whatever we can do to increase the job training, the job availability, the job assistance, I think has to be a big part of what we discuss in this committee. Mental health is another one too. Additional mental health services, and then drug treatment. We offer two different residential drug treatment programs at City Rescue Mission. So, and I think that's a huge component. If someone is suffering from some kind of addiction, that if they're in a house and they're continuing to use, it's difficult to sustain. So I think that's got to be a big part of the discussion. And I'm just saying this because we as City Rescue Mission, we care. We want to be part of the solution. We don't take any city money. So, not that we never would, but we don't take any money. So, I don't have that motive to try to get more money from the city. So, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
I've got a question for Paul, if I could. I think it relates back to, a little bit to what Dr. Marlin said with respect to all three legs of the stool. And you mentioned you don't take city funding, but I would love to get, and perhaps Deidre Connor, if she's still here, can get an assessment of what funds organizations like yours and others who are in the field doing this kind of work, what kind of support do you get, philanthropic or otherwise, to do the programs that you do? I think, and I appreciate, Ms. Gilman, the idea of having a better understanding of what the capacity of the service providers are in terms of where they are in that process, and what the private sector, I'm going to a luncheon in a few minutes with the Community Foundation, with the Donors Forum, and we'll talk about what is the private sector doing to support this initiative as well. So I appreciate getting some information from you as how you fund your organization and what your capacity is in servicing the homeless in our community.
Yeah, and I'm happy, probably the most comprehensive, and we have not had to do it for 3 years, 4 years now. With one of our state grants, we actually have to put in what is our leveraging, not match, but actual leveraging, which includes everything from what City Rescue Mission raises to run their program to what Section 8 vouchers are that are used for the homeless. It's a very large number. And to Reverend Barlow's point, like, what is it targeted for? Right now, we have a lot of programs that are doing really good work, and we still see unmet need in our community. So if we were to add any more funding, what's the target? As in, what is the goal that's out there? And I think Joe really set up great examples, especially that Philadelphia example. That was... The goal for that is we want to reduce unsheltered homelessness in a defined downtown area, right? Very, very specific, fairly set number of people, and what would it take to achieve that goal? And I don't know if, Joe, because that is your hometown, if you want to just speak a little bit more on how that came about and how big was that piece of the pie, so to speak.
Sure. So how it came about, it came out of the mayor's task force on homelessness. The mayor really raised the need to address unsheltered homelessness in the downtown business district area. But when he gave the charge, he didn't give it to the COC, but he actually gave it to the business community, the tourism and hospitality industry, as well as the Philadelphia Convention Center. And they actually took the initiative up. And what they essentially did was they put dollars on the table as well as took charge of raising dollars. And those dollars went into a philanthropic organization within the city of Philadelphia, and they administered those dollars. I think it started out as $2 million and went all the way up to $6.2 million. And essentially what they did was they used those dollars to implement specific programs, not only for outreach, but also for providing shelter and housing for those who were living on the street. But the reason why they were able to reduce panhandling, they initiated a same-day pay program where homeless individuals could actually go and work on landscaping or work on painting murals. If you know Philadelphia, we're famous for our murals, and they would get paid the same exact day that they did the work. So that same day pay program is what really contributed to that 39% reduction in panhandling. But again, it was the business community, the tourism industry, Wawa, which is, you guys probably have Royal Farms down there in Jackson.
We got Wawa now.
All right, so Wawa. Wawa is a big thing in Philadelphia. And so Wawa put up the money to support this initiative, and it was led by the business community, and it was funded by the business community as well as donations, and they funneled that through a local philanthropic organization.
Thank you so much, Joe. And I think that really emphasizes, and as I've been giving overviews, right, that today was probably the first time you've ever heard me mention a specific agency, because there is no individual agency or entity in any city that's going to end homelessness. But this really creative group from Philadelphia, they can leverage the expertise of all the agencies that are already there and they can come at it from a different direction or with a very specific target with a more flexible funding. Any of us who have worked within the federal or state system knows that it's very prescriptive on what we can and cannot do with those funding streams. So thank you again for putting that example up. And I think we had, John, you wanted to speak, sir?
Yes, I do. My name is Roosevelt Barrera, and I'm homeless. I'm also a health problems. I see shelters and stuff like that. I'm there with them. Majority of people that are homeless, they have mental problems. A lot of them just gave up on life. They use drugs and different things to be getting in. No, I don't know. Because, you know, I drink a little beer. I don't know about no other stuff. But they just gave up. Like they don't have no hope. You know, and I look around and I see why they don't have no hope. Because nobody don't care about nobody to be in the home. People pay about cars, they don't get people home, and they don't get them down. But still, they don't know that we got feelings too. I mean, you could. My daughter talked to my son in the country. I would take it home. I couldn't. Nobody went home with me.
Thank you so much. I think when I very first started many years ago working in this field, I think that one of the most impactful things someone who had experienced homelessness told me, there's the difference between one side and the other is hope. So the one thing I think any program, any help, anything we do has to infuse hope for everyone, our neighbors who are housed and unhoused, that things will be, we can fix it and things will get better. So again, I firmly believe homelessness is a solvable problem. It is something we need to decide that we will put the resources, the focus, and the time and intent to solve. So thank you so much, sir. And Brian.
I'm sorry.
Brian, no. And then, yeah, okay.
I'm Brian Snow, Chief Program Officer with Sulzbacher. I'm going to mention a few things that some people have already said. Interesting stat up there from Charlotte, North Carolina, was an income increase by 76%. Which you don't really hear discussed a whole lot. And so as Cindy and Paul and Harrison mentioned, housing, health and wellness, food insecurity, those are all things we should be targeting. In addition to that, you mentioned this earlier, Don, a lot of folks will go through rapid rehousing a much higher volume than folks that will go through permanent supportive housing. And so one of the key pieces of that has been mentioned is income. And so what I would kind of challenge us to do as a community is to talk more about workforce certifications, living wage employment, and those type things, which was mentioned by the Charlotte slide, which I rarely hear when I go to conferences and things, so that was great to hear. Somebody else that we may want to kind of bring to the table here as part of the homeless working group is maybe Goodwill and FSCJ, and you were talking about leveraging resources earlier. I know they have an A-STEPS program, which a lot of people are not aware of, even in the homeless industry. So maybe we bring them to the table, continue to talk about that. But there's no way we can deal with the homelessness issue without addressing living wage employment and those workforce certifications.
Amen. One, two.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, as some of you may know, the city is about ready to start receiving some significant dollars due to the opioid settlement. You know, from the drug companies, wholesalers, et cetera, and it's significant, and it's over 18 years. Now, those dollars are specifically targeted because of how we're getting the money specifically to drug treatment, prevention, et cetera. But I just listening here, there's clearly an overlap. And we need, and we have a working group that's presently meeting. I'm representing the council. We've got members of the administration and others. We haven't received a dime yet, but we expect to start receiving those dollars soon. But I can clearly see there's an overlap here, and we just need to be thinking about how those dollars could be leveraged, as other people have already said, in using those to help in this situation as well. I don't have the answer to that, but I just wanted to put that on the table.
Good point.
Hello, everybody. My name is Kirk Kane. I'm chronically homeless, and I did it all over the country, so I see different things and stuff. And I think there's a lot of red tape. Too many people got their hand in the pot, and they're making sure they don't be homeless while we keep us homeless at the same time. So I think that's a problem, too. Like, I think that, you know what I'm saying? So I think we need to cut red tape, right? You know what I'm saying? But make it harder for me. Like, I get income every day, I get a disability. I can't even afford a place, right? Oh, $550 a month, right? Oh, you don't make three times as much, so you don't think I can afford to pay the rent. But I make enough to pay the rent. You know what I'm saying? So there's a lot of things that's going on here that are keeping people homeless. Then what are we going to do with the money? I can't save them for so much money, right, because the government take it. Can't work because you only make $65 a month, right, and then start taking money out the check. So there's a lot of different things that's going on here that are keeping us homeless. It ain't just drugs, alcohol, mental health. It's economics, too. It may be a social environment, you know, like... I was in Seattle, I was in Los Angeles, and people had like hotels, right, paying $300 a month, right? They kicked them out, gentrification, right? Now, where are you gonna go? Who's gonna pay $300 a month? Hey, come on now, right? So now they put more people on the street. All the people that came out of those old hotels came out on the street, increased the homelessness. So there's a lot of things going on why we have a problem as it is now. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you allow me to add to that gentleman's comment, you know, he talked about the red tape and access to those services, particularly in light of the opioid settlement money that might be coming to your community. You know, access to those services is going to be a key issue and can be a barrier for a lot of persons experiencing homelessness. And something that they did in Philadelphia to increase access to those services, they did something like a 30-day exemption where a person experiencing homelessness, if they did not have identification, they could still go directly into treatment right then and there, and they had 30 to 60 days to get the identification and the other necessary documentation. So that was a way of eliminating that red tape up front so that people can have immediate access to services. And through that initiative, they were able to get 40% of the individuals living in encampments into treatment. So eliminating that red tape is very important by getting creative.
Interesting.
Yep. Thank you, Joe. And I can see most of the audience. Are there any other questions or comments? I know Cindy's behind the pillar, but I can't see her anymore.
She's fine.
Okay.
I can see her.
You can see her. Okay. With that, Joe, thank you so much for joining us this morning out of your busy schedule, and I hope next time we get to see you possibly in person.
All right. Thank you all. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. Thank you.
I'm going to just do a quick sum, if that's good, and then pass it on to our city council members for anyone else. Just in taking a few notes, especially as Joe was going through his presentation, I think because there is an affordable housing committee, I want to make sure everybody is really clear. There's affordable housing, and then there's what we refer to as deeply affordable housing, right? Deeply affordable housing means someone who is on Social Security disability to zero income, right? So extremely low income individuals still can move directly into that housing. It is extraordinarily scarce in our community. And part of the discussion that comes around that is there's no way to build that housing without additional economic subsidies or incentives, whether you're a for-profit or nonprofit builder. So when we're talking about reducing or eliminating homelessness, we have to focus in. We need workforce housing, right? No question about that. We also need to understand there is a different level of housing subsidy that is needed to actually allow people to move directly off the streets and into housing that then they can maintain ongoing. There's a lot of talk about workforce development and income with rapid rehousing. When I talk about rapid rehousing, the best definition I've ever heard for rapid rehousing is consider it a limited housing subsidy that is an income or work program, right? So at the end of that assistance, we have to make sure that household is able to maintain the housing that is in their name, that they can go on and be successful. For context, yes, we do have a by name list that we maintain here in Jacksonville. On it right now is approximately 3,400 individuals. When we talk about looking at different categories, we do break it out by all those categories. One of the ones that I am especially interested in is across the country, homelessness kind of splits like this in age. We see it, young adults are considered 18 to 25. And we look at older adults at 65 and up. While we are seeing an increase in young adults, we are seeing a much more rapid increase in older individuals on the streets. Anecdotally, we are attributing that to just that incredible increase that we have all seen in housing costs. And it is more likely for an older individual to be on a fixed income and just not able. So that... that is something I am extraordinarily interested in and have been trying to find funding specifically for that group of individuals. The last data poll that I had my folks do, if you're looking at 55 and up chronically homeless individuals, we know by name 191. So it is an issue we really need to address. Those are the folks that are most likely to, they are the folks that I am most likely to read their name at the homeless memorial unless we can figure out a way to get them off the streets and into housing. And that goes back to those targeted investments that different people were asking questions about. It goes back to, like, what is the goal? If the goal of the community comes back to me and says, we want to ensure anyone 55 and up and chronically homeless, we want to ensure that they are not on the streets, we can design a program that would target those individuals and probably get awfully close to it. I mean, the good thing, when you looked at those extraordinary numbers, like 98% success rate, I look at our permanent supportive housing. They're there. If we have a slot and can get that person in, our agencies are really good about supporting them and having them be successful. And funding is limited, right? That there is a cost for housing. There is a cost for those supportive services. There is a cost for mental health services that we need to make sure are wrapped around different individuals and families. So... when we send everything out, I'm going to send a link to pre-COVID. We commissioned a study for strategies to reduce unsheltered homelessness. Like, what is the feasibility of significantly reducing the people who are in our community that cannot afford to come in? So for those of you who like numbers and data, and it's there. We have demonstrated time and time again with different programs, it is much less expensive to house a chronically homeless person than to allow them to remain homeless, because we are paying for it. We're just paying for it through a lot of different systems. So I will also encourage you I am hopeful that we will have a lot of affordable housing projects coming up in our community. So when they are out and there is time for public comment, I want everyone to remember that if you believe in equity, if you believe in developing the economy, and if you believe in the ecology, those all benefit when we have more affordable housing. People live closer to where they work, they have the opportunity to work, and everyone is able to afford those places. So I will pause again, and I need to ask, I forget that this is a city council meeting, do we have any public comment cards? We do.
Oh, we do have some.
Perfect. Then I'll turn it back over to my city council colleagues. Reverend Barlow, you're our card. Would you like to speak again?
Again and again.
I wouldn't like to, but I have to. Just give me 1 second.
You got it.
Put this on the phone, so I got to find it now. Where am I? Let somebody go to it for me.
Okay. Would you like to go, ma'am?
I have a question.
Could you come up to the actually, yeah, we do, because I think they're recording. If you could come up to the mic, that would be.
And then please do state your name.
Good morning.
And address.
Yeah. My name is April Holloway, and my question is really for Ms. Gilman specifically. I am a property manager and have had the extreme pleasure of working with Changing Homeless, specifically the rapid rehousing. But when we talk about the targeted group of 55 plus, do you agree or disagree that term, because when we talk about rapid rehousing, our end goal is to make them or ensure that they're self-sufficient with all the services they need. But when we talk about 55 plus, it seems like it's going to be a longer end goal for them, and what will happen in a year when they are still in the same situation, they're still 55 plus, and on a fixed income. What do we have planned for that outcome?
So that is a great question. Normally, if we had enough permanent supportive housing, probably most of them would be moved in and referred to a permanent supportive housing program. As a community, we made the decision that if they were the most vulnerable on our by name list, and if we did not have permanent supportive housing, but we did have rapid rehousing for them, we offered it because we felt it was more important to move people off of the street and provide that opportunity. We had known from another large rapid rehousing program, even if we just offered rapid rehousing to persons who were chronically homeless, usually between 60 and 70% of those people were still in housing a year later. We were able to get their income up to it. Now, that was, again, pre-COVID. I get that the rental rates and different things have switched. And if you'll, one thing I think that is critical when we talk about a living wage and being able to afford, in 2019, I would have talked to you about $15 an hour. We are now at $20 an hour and up to be able to be a single adult, work 40 hours a week, and afford a place. Average rent in Duval County for one bedroom is now over $1,000. Again, we search all the time for deeply affordable housing. It's extremely difficult, even with a team talking to landlords, to find those types of rents.
From a agenda perspective, we'll consider that that question and answer session the last part of the member discussion, and now we'll formally move into public comment, where we have one public comment card. It's Dr. and Reverend Barlow, if you wouldn't mind, sir, stating your name and address.
Alvin Wellington Barlow, Senior with Help and Housing for the Homeless, which is a DBA of Breakthrough for Ministries, a Florida-based 501c3, 625 West Union Street, 322-02. I'm here to speak up for the homeless who roam the streets of this city begging for that which many of us take for granted: food, clothing, and shelter, the basic necessities of life. While they beg and live like animals outside, fighting to stay cool in the summer, warm in the winter, our city grants and forgivable loans to wealthy people with absolutely no condition that any of such corporate welfare of the rich should be reserved for the poor. I strongly recommend the adoption of a city ordinance that will earmark 5% of all grants and forgivable loans for a housing for the homeless fund that will secure permanent housing by covering deposits, rent, rent subsidies, assistance with utilities, and the like. Last year, the city gave away over $500 million to rich people to basically get even richer on the backs of taxpayers. Measly 5% of that sum could have eradicated homelessness in Jacksonville, but that seems too good to implement. With all due respect to the experts, whom I greatly appreciate for the excellent job you are doing in assessing the problem, however, if you knew the answers, we would not be having these meetings trying to figure out how to adequately address homelessness. Although I am not a housing expert, here's the bottom line. Something bold, different, and radical must be done if we collectively are serious about eradicating homelessness, which is highly possible. If we keep doing what we've done, we'll get what we've already gotten. Now I want to share something with you that God shared with me as I woke at 3 a.m. this morning. It's absolutely chilling. So please hear what thus says the Lord in Isaiah chapter 10 in the New Living Translation. What sorrow awaits unjust judges and those who issue unfair laws. They deprive the poor of justice and deny the rights of the needy among my people. They prey on widows and take advantage of orphans. What will you do when I punish you, when I send disaster upon you from a distant land? To whom will you turn for help? Where will your treasures be safe? Jesus confirms this in verses 41 through 43 of Matthew 25 with these words. The king will turn to those on the left hand and say, away with you, you cursed ones, into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his demons. For I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was thirsty and you didn't give me drink. I was a stranger and you didn't take me in. I was naked and you didn't give me clothing. I was sick and in prison and you didn't visit me. Please, ma'ams and sirs, forgive me for this, but this is what God put in my spirit. And I'm fighting back tears right now because these are my friends. I see these people every day. Talk about paying people on the spot. He got paid yesterday, called my office asking for help, and I paid him to clean up a lot that the city won't pay for. So we do that right now. And just like I said, please forgive me. These are my friends. I know them personally. And I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that they're taken care of. And I'm not asking for the city to do it. We need to make the business community do it, that we give the money to.
Reverend Barlow, thank you so much. That was our last comment card. Don, do you have any further comments before we go? Councilman Boylan?
First of all, I thank you all for being here again. And it's really important for everyone who came up to the microphone and shared. We're counting on you to garner this information and to share it with you. I want to thank Dawn Lockhart and her staff for the support, and Dr. Moreland's comments today. I heard a word the other day, or a phrase the other day. We talk about affordable housing and deeply affordable housing and workforce housing. The new phrase that I heard, and I kind of wish we had it beforehand, was attainable housing, because workforce housing, affordable housing already have that sort of nomenclature as to what people see when they talk about those. So there is clearly a differentiation. What we are talking about here is affordable housing, an opportunity to get people into it, transition them into an affordable home in this process. Dr. Barlow, I appreciate very much your passion. I think, you know, we share it in a different way. Our intent to do this kind of work was purposeful, to get to new ideas, to better ideas, to get better focus on how we do what we do. And I want to thank the co-chairs in this process, and as well Northeast Florida Regional Council, Noel, and his staff for the work they're going to be doing. Again, the vision at the end of the day is for us to come up with a comprehensive report that addresses all these issues. Economic mobility came into play today's conversation, critical in this process and something we need to pull into this conversation. And I look forward to the recommendations of this committee, a working group, at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice President Salem.
I'm just sitting here learning, and it's just amazing what you learn just by sitting here.
Thank you, sir. And Ms. Gilman, you have a plan for next meeting, right, that we can share? Next meeting is scheduled for 9 a.m. on October 13th?
Yes. So a couple people in the audience have worked with Community Solutions and the Built for Zero group. This comes tailored to Reverend Barlow's question. What do you do? What do you do something Not necessarily new or different. We have found that we can make amazing progress doing things that seem really basic, but it's following that data and making sure that you know who is homeless and who is getting housed and never letting anyone slip through the cracks. So K.O. Campbell from Community Solutions is going to talk about that. And it's going to be more focused on our work on veteran homelessness, just so you have the Jacksonville data, so you can see what is happening here and what could happen in other subpopulations with similar levels of funding.
Thank you, Dawn. And I'll just wrap it up with this. To me, this was a special meeting today. We heard about the issues, both indirectly and very poignantly directly. We heard data from Dr. Moreland and Dr. Savage, and we heard ideas, which is how a meeting should go. The next meeting, as Dawn said, is going to be about other things that cities have done, just like today was while Dr. Savage spoke. But what's obvious to me is that there has been significant investment by our city, by our charitable organizations, by private organizations to solve the issue of homelessness in Jacksonville. It's obvious that there is significant interest in all the stakeholders in our city to do so. And it's obvious that we're making progress. I mean, the one thing that I saw on the data presented by Dr. Moreland is that there has been a 52% reduction of people experiencing homelessness over the last 10 years. That's pretty remarkable. But that doesn't mean that what we've done before is necessarily the right thing to do going forward. And that's what we'll be looking at in meeting 3, meeting 4, and meeting 5. I've got a lot of civic pride. So if they can solve this issue or reduce chronic homelessness in places like Orlando, Philadelphia, and Evansville, Indiana, then we can certainly do it better here in Jacksonville. So I look forward to figuring out with this group. Thank you again, everyone, for being here. And meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm being recognized. I'm one of the honorees.